Latin American News.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on when you're listening to this. So I went back to school and just life happened while I was there. And because of all those things, this podcast fell by the wayside. And while I would love to promise that I will be able to continue, there are some things in the nearby future that will prevent me from doing it every single week. But with all that said, there has been a lot that I've missed out on with my absence. So this one is going to be a bit longer than usual with some stories that might have happened recently as well as a while ago, and I will give you the rough dates in which they happened to give you a good timeline. And as always, we're going to start off with Mexico. Around April, the DEA in Mexico had elite units begin leaving. This caused much worry to legislators in the Senate about what this means, and especially when it comes to the cooperation with Mexico about drugs coming into the United States. Planes that were used for special operations have also left the country, bringing them even more worry to members of the Senate, which has forced them to write a letter to the DEA to ask about what's actually going on. Some members of the Senate have also sent a letter to the DEA asking why they have made this move and are currently waiting to just hear back from the DEA. Also in April, Mexico began the process of nationalizing mining of lithium in their country. This is quite a big move because the nationalization of just about anything creates an issue for countries like the United States that are trying to somewhat exploit those sectors for profit while giving very little back to the country. With this process of nationalization, they've also included a clause allowing for the state to take charge of, quote, other mining declared strategies by Mexico. While this actual process is yet to be finalized with a deadline of 90 days from the announcement to create a body to deal with all things lithium, which doesn't happen until July, we shall see how this affects the relationship between the United States and Canada with their NAFTA deal. Back in November, there was an incident in Baja Pitima, Puerto Morales, which is about 50 miles south of Cancun, with two rival gangs in the area which were having a dispute and many tourists had to hide in the basement of a Hyatt hotel. While no serious injuries were reported by the tourists, the issue does raise the question of safety in Mexico and if the rise of gang violence in Mexico is going to begin to bleed more into the tourist areas of Mexico. With summer right around the corner, this issue is something that has to be taken into account and into consideration, since for a long time there was no ability to actually vacation and travel during the summer, and we might see a huge spike in Mexico when it comes to travel and tourists, which in turn might mean a rise in violence. In the next story, we'll be talking about a fairly long topic that is still affecting many families, especially in Central America. Since the Trump administration, immigration to the United States from the southern border has become something that has taken a backseat in the Biden administration, with the crisis of Ukraine taking priority. Recently, families have had to have been separated for months or just now starting to reunite, and with the Title 42, it has become increasingly difficult to come into the United States, especially for those who already have family in the U.S. or are coming with their parents. Increasingly, families in Guatemala have started to send their children over to the Mexican border to cross into the United States in hope that they will be able to get a better life for them than the ones that they give them. During this process of trying to either seek asylum in the United States or trying to make a better life in the U.S., many minors were lost in the system within the U.S., which made it very difficult for some of them to be reunited with their families and taken back to their country of origin. The months of not knowing where a family's child might be created a shroud of sadness, not knowing if they didn't make it because of the journey or because they were lost in the system. With the Biden administration taking over, this has slowly begun to improve. However, not fast enough, according to some, with the deportation of children back to their families, especially those in the shelters in Mexico. On the 21st of December, 2021, grieving family members blocked a major road in Guatemala with the coffins of victims of the weekend of a massacre by a rival group to draw attention to the violence plaguing their indigenous community. This conflict, according to the police officials, has gone on for hundreds of years, and it seems like no matter what, it is a conflict that has no sudden end. If you have followed this podcast since last year, at least, then you know that almost every time we have talked, we've talked about El Salvador and how it's tried to move into the crypto world, not only making it an official currency within the country, but the government itself buying bitcoins. El Salvador has suffered because of this move, with the IMF no longer backing them and even putting the country in a junk currency market. This move has created massive uncertainty within the country. Not only that, but this push has also scared away many potential investors, specifically because of the recent volatility of Bitcoin. And the president's decision to double down by buying 500 more coins with government funds has made it even more difficult for outside governments to believe in Bitcoin. At this moment, Bitcoin has dropped over 50% since September of last year, while also rising and then falling dramatically. The president still plans on making a Bitcoin city with a proposed tax advantage jurisdiction on the country's coast with geothermal energy to power crypto mining. Yet only 5% of the transactions that are made within the app developed by the government to make sales in Bitcoin transferred into dollars almost immediately. As I always say, we will see what happens with El Salvador, just because it seems like the president still wants to push Bitcoin to the forefront of El Salvador's economy, but it's very uncertain. Moving away from Bitcoin, let's go and look at what El Salvador's government is doing to suppress and even silence media that is not favorable to them. Back in January, around 37 devices were found to have NSO's Pegasus malware, and of those 37, 35 were found on journalists and activists as recently as November of last year. Out of those 35, 23 were found on the journalists who work for El Faro, a publication that has been targeted by the government with audits and has also been accused of tax evasion. Some individuals were alerted by Apple that their devices might have malware in them, and some were targeted several times. While the NSO group has denied having any such active spyware in El Salvador and stated that their programs are made to track terrorists and for government and law enforcement to use them to help assist threats, they have too often been known to look the other way when it comes to terms of how the software is used by the government they license them to. Moving over to Honduras, we're seeing a rise in not only the trafficking of drugs through Honduras as an issue that it has been in the past, but as well as a popular route for its coastline in the U.S., either by boats or planes. However, traffickers have also now moved into the mountains to facilitate the production of coca leaves themselves. While production isn't as big as Colombia, Peru, or Bolivia, some anti-trafficker members believe that if left unchecked, it could potentially become a massive producer due to its geographical location, with the mountain ranges making it a very strategic base of operation. Some plantations even have Wi-Fi antennas installed to alert their workers of impending raids where there isn't cellular service. To make it to these regions, it requires up to an 8-mile hike, which gives them more than enough time to flee without being captured. One thing I did not even know about until I started researching for this podcast is that Honduras has voted in their first female president, Xiomara Castro, who was sworn into office on the 27th of January. Vice President Kamala Harris was in attendance and also pledged the support of the U.S. government to promote migration and fight corruption. While this was a time for celebration in Honduras, with the loss of the Conservative Party and Castro being a democratic socialist who pledges to take the country out of its $15.5 billion debt, as well as allow for access to electricity in poor communities, the largest pressing issue is whether or not Honduras will continue the relationship with Taiwan or move their allegiance to China. At the moment, the most pressing issue is that the former president has been accused by the U.S. of corruption and drug trafficking, whose brother last year was sentenced to life in prison in the U.S. and 30 years for drug trafficking. While some U.S. lawmakers have made moves for the extradition of the former president, he has been sworn in as a member of the Central American Parliament shortly after Castro's inauguration, putting off extradition for up to 4 years. For now, Castro has very big plans for Honduras, and many things are happening around her, so we shall see how she maneuvers the debt and the weight that she has inherited. Moving to a country in South America that is increasingly becoming more and more authoritarian, Nicaragua. It has slowly become more and more difficult to get news from this country that isn't state-manufactured propaganda. But last month, the government decided to close its office of the Organization of American States and expel the staff. This move comes after the ambassador to OAS, Arturo McFields, came out and criticized the government, stating, "To denounce the dictatorship of my country is not easy, but to keep this silent and to defend what isn't defensible is impossible." A bold move from McFields, who until then had defended Ortega's government when it was criticized by members of the OAS. Since his statement, the government of Nicaragua has stated that this is not the belief of their government and that his appointment is no longer in effect. With this expulsion and media becoming more and more controlled within Nicaragua, covering this country in particular may become increasingly difficult, with very few media sources no longer being independent or of the state-run media. Going further into the topic of dictatorship and authoritarian government of Nicaragua, back in February, the government launched its largest attack on higher education in a move never seen in Central America. They took away the licenses of many privately funded institutions for not providing detailed information on their finance and directors. While the universities have stated that they have, arguing that this move is in relation to the support of the students in the 2018 anti-government protest in which 350 people were killed by security forces. The most well-known institution in Nicaragua, the Pollyanna University of Nicaragua, was at the epicenter of anti-government protests and was one of the first to now be replaced by the government's National Council of Universities for Institutional Management. This move is seen by many to undermine students, which are one of the last few groups in Nicaragua fighting for a free and democratic system of government. So, I'm going to talk about two things here. The first being the election that took place earlier this year in Costa Rica, and then the first international visit made by the new president. In Costa Rica, the presidency can be won by just 40% of the vote in the first round outright. However, this is much harder to do since there are usually multiple candidates running. With so many voters remaining undecided until election day, it is oftentimes very difficult to even predict a winner of the election in Costa Rica until the votes are actually being counted. By February, they predicted that the winner was José María Figueras. The actual winner of the presidential race at the end of the day was Rodrigo Chávez, who took his first trip to Switzerland to attend the World Economic Forum. While attending, he presented an image of Costa Rica that I think many were surprised to hear about. He stated that Costa Rica has had a significant deterioration, and that there is too much pollution in the rivers, and that the country has invested excessively in electricity generation, especially in the forms of fossil fuels. He spoke about the tax issues within the country and noted that while the tax distribution idea is good, and many agree that it is good, it has not been good for the people. While he has gone on to criticize previous administrations for the mishandling and how some businesses have been structured, like the monopolies of agrochemicals and medicine, he said that he is planning to end this and hopes to bring more investment into the country during this summit. While COVID-19 is not a thing of the past, Panama is already starting to worry about the next disease that might hit. Monkeypox has now hit the Department of Health as an alert that must be taken into account and has redoubled its epidemiological surveillance has been ordered into the ports of entry into the country. Because of Panama's location at the center of Latin America, they are naturally overly cautious, especially after COVID-19 pandemic. With no cases being found within the country, that has not stopped them from making sure that their borders are secure. There is one story that I want to talk about in this country, and I want to cover it, but it is very long to fit into just a 5-minute talking point. So next week, there will be just a whole entire episode dedicated to Panama and the economic and democratic success of Latin America that no one anticipated. Moving over to Puerto Rico, we see a historic movement in Congress. After 124 years of a colonial status in Puerto Rico, there is a bill being proposed to allow the people of Puerto Rico to decide their fate by giving them three options: statehood, sovereignty and free association with the United States, and independence. Each of these would mean different things for Puerto Rico, but all have the same conclusion, and that is to make sure that those in Puerto Rico no longer feel like they are second-class citizens of America. While this bill is yet to be introduced, it is a major step forward by lawmakers that are willing to give Puerto Rico either statehood or full independence. The 51-page long document says a vote would take place on November 5th, 2023. If no option earns a majority vote, there would be a runoff election in March of 2024. Back in January, a judge actually slashed the island's public debt load as a part of a restructuring and allowed the government to start repaying its creditors. The board said that the plan signed by the federal judge Laura Taylor Swine cuts Puerto Rico's public debt by about 80% and saves the island more than $50 billion in debt service payments as some creditors agreed to deep cuts. Board members noted the plan reduces the claims against the government from $33 billion to just over $7.4 billion, with 7 cents of every taxpayer dollar going to debt service, compared to what the previous 25 cents was. While at the moment this move has not created any kind of economic turmoil, this municipal bankruptcy move is very historic, with Puerto Rico having 4 times more debt than the city of Detroit. While this historic move is just one more step toward Puerto Rico and its people becoming more economically stable place, there is still a long way to go. Going over to Colombia, we see the rise of another leftist presidential candidate. Gustavo Petro is almost like a Colombian Bernie Sanders at 62 years old. For now, he is the forerunner of the election and is predicted to win, with the promises of overhauling the country's capitalist economic model and vastly expanding social programs, pledging to introduce guaranteed work with a basic income, shift the country to a publicly controlled health system, and increase access to higher education in part by raising taxes on the rich. The vote happens this Sunday, and while many speculate that there will be a runoff vote in June, for now the momentum that Petro has made might be enough to win him the election. Just as in Peru, when there was a leftist winning, many spoke of the downfall of the economy and are doing so with Colombia as well, because of Petro's push to not explore more oil extraction. Many young people in Colombia have protested Iván Duque and his government for his mismanagement of COVID-19, as well as not addressing many key issues for the youth vote, like income gaps, while his supporters are not diluting themselves with the fact that Petro might not be able to fix everything, they are hopeful that this will lead to real change within the country. Colombia is a country that's known for its violence, specifically of the drug trade. A report made in the 18th of January 2022 says that 145 civil society leaders were killed by criminals in 2021. While this number changes depending on the organization, like the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights listing 78 confirmed killings, and Indipaz, an advocacy group, says 171 leaders were murdered. While this number is down in comparison to the years prior to the 2016 peace deal with FARC, the numbers are still very high. This past Wednesday, the 25th of May, Miguel Pochete Santeña, better known as Gentile Durante, who led one faction of the former FARC rebels, is presumed to be dead in Venezuela. While there was a peace deal with most of FARC's members back in 2016, many fled to Venezuela to continue their drug trafficking and illegal mining activities, while Venezuela denies any involvement in allowing former FARC members to have any kind of presence in their country. It is believed that Colombia's intelligence that many members fled to Venezuela. In another development, Wednesday last year, Venezuela was supposed to have peace talks between the official government of Venezuela and the opposition. While Norway was meant to act as the intermediary body, the discussion broke down last year in October, and while talks are meant to continue this June, the Venezuelan government is now asking Russia, as a strong ally, to become the new intermediary between the two. Norway's history of helping broker peace in Latin America is backed by the 2016 Colombia FARC peace deal they helped broker and bring to a non-neutral party like Russia can mark the end of these peace talks. Ecuador's youth is also raising their voice in unison against the government and its inability to protect them from the pollution that is killing them. In 2021, a court had decided that gas flares violated the constitutional rights of people in those areas to a healthy environment, ordering the government to eliminate flares near inhabited areas over the next year and a half. While the government has yet to comply with this ruling, many indigenous groups and farmers in the affected regions are still suffering. Back in January, Ecuador also expanded its marine life protection into the Galapagos Islands, extending their migration pattern protections to Costa Rica. The new boundary is of the first step in ultimately linking the marine reserves of Colombia, Costa Rica, Ecuador, and Panama together to form an eastern tropical Pacific marine corridor. It covers important migratory routes for several species endangered of extinction, including sea turtles, whales, sharks, and manta rays, as well as tuna. The region also includes some of the world's few remaining well-preserved coral reefs. Part of this expansion and protection comes from the fact that China is expanding its fishing fleets within the region, which has caused some sharks to become endangered. This story happened back in February, but the Peruvian Prime Minister Hector Valor confirmed that he would step down 4 days after being named for the post after allegations that he beat his daughter and late wife. In doing so, it has caused a massive reshuffling of the government again. Under the Peruvian constitution, when the prime minister steps down, the entire cabinet must follow suit until the replacement is nominated and a new ministerial team is chosen. While Valor's party affiliation only recently changed from being a right wing to the president Castillo's Marxist leftist party, Castillo himself has moved more and more toward the right since taking office back in July. While oftentimes the left is associated with LGBTQ+ rights, legal abortion, and sex education, Castillo is opposed to all of these things and has come out as a social conservative. This next story is about Peru and Bolivia. A powerful 7.2 magnitude earthquake rattled large areas of Peru, Bolivia on Thursday, the 26th of May. The quake struck southern Peru in the Andes Mountain north of Lake Titicaca, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. There were no immediate reports of injuries or damage from the quake, and no tsunami warnings were issued. The USGS reported that the quake occurred around 220 kilometers below ground, at a depth that usually causes less damage than more shallow seismic activities. The quake began around 7:02 local time, and the tremors rippled through the region, building sway in the Peruvian cities of Arequipa and Cusco, as well as La Paz, the capital of Bolivia. In a press release by the Department of Justice on the 2nd of February of 2022, Maximino de Villa Perez is formally being charged with conspiracy to import cocaine into the U.S. as well as a related weapons offense involving conspiracy to use and possess machine guns. Davia Perez, a former senior Bolivian government official who was entrusted with leading Bolivia's anti-narcotic agency, worked in partnership with drug labs and sought to send more than 1,000 kilograms of cocaine into the United States. He further used his position of power by transporting the drugs with machine guns that were government provided. This past Thursday, scientists might have discovered the oldest tree in the world. Dr. Jonathan Barcevici has suggested that a tree in the Patagonia could be up to 5,484 years old, while the Alerce Milino would outstrip the 4,853-year-old bristlecone pine in California known as Methuselah, and now thought to be the oldest tree by 600 years. For now, it has not been fully proven because the rings of the tree have yet to be counted, yet he does hope to do so and prove it in the coming months. Back in February, Cristina Calderon died at the age of 93. She was the last living speaker and guardian of an ancestral cultural language called Yamana. While she was able to make a dictionary from Yamana to Spanish, and there is some hope of keeping the knowledge of that language, there are some root words that are still unknown. Moving to Uruguay, they are set to decommission some Argentine planes and purchase some new ones from Brazil for $40 million. In an interview with the defense minister of Uruguay, he stated that this is in part to keep up to date with the rest of the countries around Uruguay, as well as expand their Air Force capabilities. Back in February, Uruguay also began the process of receiving three former U.S. Coast Guard ships in hopes of creating a more bilateral union between the two nations, as well as helping Uruguay enhance its maritime security. This move is being called a win-win by both nations. The ships themselves will not be in Uruguayan waters until members of the Uruguayan Navy are fully trained in the maintenance and operation of these vessels. For many years, Panama has enjoyed the luxury of the Panama Canal, but Paraguay has decided to take that challenge head-on by trying to construct the roadway between Brazil and Chile. This roadway, which is a pet project, especially the Paraguay, which is a landlocked country, would save logistically 14 days of travel and $1,000 per barrel of good. While this project still requires much planning between different countries, it has already brought a positive change in Paraguay by making a formerly 12-hour-long journey from Camino Peralta to Loma Plata in only 4 hours. Some do worry that this Trans-Chaco Highway, as they call it, will bring some drug and alcohol abuse to local communities with truck stops and diners beginning to pop up. However, many believe that this is a small price to pay for the jobs and economic opportunity that it would bring Paraguay. Back in January, many German-speaking anti-vaxxers were seen to have fled to Paraguay. In a poor region of Paraguay, you will find a gated community dubbed the Green Paradise, which is said to be a refuge from the, quote, socialist trends of current economic and political situations worldwide, as well as 5G chemtrails, fluoridated waters, mandatory vaccination, and healthcare mandates. While many in Paraguay are worried by this influx of Europeans moving into the country, some Germans have been rejected from entering the country due to the surge last year of COVID within the country, causing new restrictions on travel to come into place. For now, they're just being left alone, but not without some disdain from locals for how they have set up their new little community. Lithium mining has become the new gold rush, or the new oil, if you will. With so many things now using lithium as their main source for batteries, Argentina has been able to position itself and become the new mecca for lithium mining. Bidding wars have begun between U.S. companies like Tesla and China to secure their ability to have electric cars. China has long been a global power, and with its rise in global power came its wanting to become a global influencer. This has taken root in their Belt and Road Plan, which is now a massive project globally that has begun to extend to South America. So far, Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Chile, and Uruguay have all signed. Argentina is now one of the newest members to join this group, with only Brazil and Colombia remaining as the last big players in South America. This visit of Alberto Fernandez to Beijing comes ahead of the 50th anniversary of Argentina and China establishing diplomatic relations, creating more celebrations between the two nations. Another nation that has had recent issues with police brutality is Brazil. This past Thursday, Givandio de Jesus Santos, who was 38, was killed by police after a stop on a highway in Brazil. Santos, who suffered from schizophrenia, was gassed on the side of the road. This has now sparked a movement in Brazil against the right-wing government of Jair Bolsonaro, who has not only allowed but called for almost warlike raids across Brazil. Before this incident, just the day before, 21 people were killed during a police operation in Rio de Janeiro. With Santos being black, it has caused an almost George Floyd-type protest in Brazil, which is also known for its police history of discrimination and use of disproportionate force against black men. While this is a recent event and protests are sparking all over the country, it is unclear if there will be any kind of change within the government. The Brazilian election is quickly coming up, and Bolsonaro's massive loss in popularity over the last few years has now hit him hard in the polls. Back in October, he was at 16% in the general election. After a cash handout to the poorer populations of Brazil, he has jumped to 19% in the polls as of February. He is still behind former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who is still a little under 28% in the polls. As we get close to the election, the pressure will surely begin to ramp up of all the issues caused by Bolsonaro's administration, with a long list of things to account for. It will be interesting to see if Bolsonaro will be re-elected, or if another left-leaning president will be elected in South America. Now, that is it for this week. Again, I apologize for just the delay in all of this, but I hope you guys still subscribe to either Spotify, Apple, and leave a rating. It always helps, and I will see you guys next week.